This copyrighted broadcast is presented by All Paws Pet Talk Radio and may not be reproduced or retransmitted in any form. Any information or segments of this show and all of the shows may not be disseminated without express written consent from the All Paws Pet Talk producer.
Medical information obtained from our website or the live show is not intended to be a substitute for professional care. If your pet has or you suspect they might have an illness or other medical condition, you should consult a health care provider. The opinions expressed on this radio program are not necessarily those of All Paws Pet Talk, this radio show, or their sponsors.
Hi, welcome to All Paws Pet Talk Radio and TV. My name is Chris Rubin, your pet industry pro and host. My co-hosts today are Janice Weiss, Columbia graduate, dog and horse behaviorist and trainer. Welcome, Janice. Dr. Don Canfer, trained at the Veterinary Medical School of Parma, Italy, and has had a private mixed practice in Europe and Florida. Welcome, Doc. And Morgan Hultquist, she is the manager of strategy and impact at Meals on Wheels. She's our special guest today. Welcome, Morgan. Thank you for being here. So I want to get started today as we do with animal news you can use. This is a really disturbing trend as the economy kind of parallels some of the economic conditions we're seeing now. And one of the reasons we're thrilled that Morgan is on the show is because there's a lot of food insecurity out there, and that extends to pet food insecurity. So today on Animal News You Can Use, I want to share with you some results from a study from veterinarians.org. You can check that out anytime you want on your own time, but 50% of the survey respondents, in this case 1,000 people with pets, said that they're having to search for cheaper alternatives for their pet foods, their treats. And I can tell you, talking to some of these big retailers, especially in this pet specialty space, their treat aisles are hurting in terms of sales because people really have to watch their dollars. Or people are making the choice to shop where they buy their food and not make the extra trip to the pet specialty store because gas is too expensive and inflation is eating their lunch. A lot of you out there, you probably have an auto ship with Chewy or Amazon where your food delivers every so often because that's how you choose to purchase your pet food. Well, 55% of the survey respondents here are saying they're having to turn those off because of the prevailing economic conditions. And the saddest part of all of this, honestly, is that 24% of the respondents are considering or already in the process of surrendering their animals to a shelter because they can no longer afford them. So that's where talking to somebody like Morgan, who is dealing with this on the front line, this is an incredible trend that's going to actually probably accelerate over the next few months. And so, Morgan, help us understand how Meals on Wheels is able to not only help humans, but their furry family members.
It's a great question, and thank you guys for having me here today. I'm really excited to be here. You know, I think when most people initially think or hear of Meals on Wheels, they often, you know, reasonably so, go immediately to food delivery for humans, of course, and that's really just the beginning of what so many community-based organizations provide within their local areas and local neighborhoods. But the reality is, too, that frequent meal deliveries often open the door to a wide range of other social connection opportunities. And in this case, I'm excited to talk about what we call our pet assistance programs. And so I think everybody here knows that pets are, of course, beloved companions and really can provide critical connection for humans, but also for homebound older adults. But we, of course, also know, as it was just mentioned, that, you know, owning a pet can take a physical and financial toll as well. And so that's why a lot of local Meals on Wheels programs, nearly 500 actually, provide services such as pet food deliveries, supplies as well. So cat litter, treats, toys, things like that. And then it also goes beyond that, which we can talk about later, but they also provide access to veterinary care, grooming, emergency boarding, and then services like dog walking as well. And not to, I know we just talked about a lot of stats, so I don't want to throw another number in there, but back in 2021, with the support of PetSmart Charities, we did a really large study with Meals on Wheels clients and actually found, you know, even before all the inflation kicked in, that more than one in five clients actually reported going without food of their own to feed their pets within the last 2 years. So those numbers were definitely staggering beforehand, and, you know, I'm sure continue to grow just with inflation and the things that you've mentioned too.
Morgan, I have a question for you, and I think it's something that a lot of people realize or maybe don't realize when they're getting a pet. I think people who are adopting dogs don't get the entire economical impact that it may have. They don't budget for it. Like when you have a new baby, you don't budget for, wow, I can't believe how many diapers there are. I can't believe how much this everything costs. And I think part of it is when people are adopting pets or purchasing from a quote unquote breeder or reputable AKC show breeder of merit, the legitimate breeders, like I know when I breed Rhodesian Ridgebacks, I have some 4-week-old puppies upstairs, and I put people through like a major inquisition of, like, you know, it's going to cost you about $60 to $70 a month for this good dog food. It's going to cost you between $50 and $60 a month for pet insurance. Make sure that you understand that. And what we see is that, unfortunately, a lot of people in the adoption community with shelters and rescues, I don't think they educate the potential adopters. Is that something you see where people kind of come to you and say, I didn't know it was going to be this expensive. I never thought about, I'd see dog food, I thought it'd be like $20 a month. And they don't realize all of the things that they really should have been educated about. Is that something you see with Meals on Wheels, that people just really didn't know what they were getting into?
It's a great question. You know, I definitely see what you're saying in terms of adoption along any front. Like, there isn't often information provided about the number of vaccines that are needed or kind of that preventative care that needs to take place. And I will say with our work, we don't specifically focus on adoptions. Typically, Meals on Wheels providers kind of come in after the client has adopted the pet. Maybe they've had the pet for several years, and that's when they start providing services. So that's typically, I'm sure, something that's seen just in terms of, you know, things across the board of, oh, I didn't know, especially with vet care costs rising, that, you know, a rabies shot was going to cost me this much. But I think that's the same, you know, kind of with anybody who owns a pet. One thing that I will say that Meals on Wheels providers have done a really phenomenal job about is also finding ways to get information to clients just about kind of caring for a pet, answering questions, really focusing on things that can help with long-term care. So, you know, are we providing our Meals on Wheels clients with pet food that is, you know, a consistent brand, something that's not going to upset their stomach, kind of pieces along those lines, if that answers the question.
I do have another question. What do you find is the biggest population needing help right now? Is it seniors? I know I do a lot of pro bono work with shelters and rescues and seniors and such, but it seems like the demographics have changed a lot because of COVID, where a lot of people who maybe wouldn't have had a dog or an animal before, because they all of a sudden were home and thought it was a great idea to have, you know, a pet since they were home, not realizing now they're going back to work or maybe they're still unemployed. Do you see a particular group or age group or demographic who's particularly impacted, or is it kind of all across the board?
It's a great question. You know, I think I'm pretty specific in my work that I do only work and focus on kind of the older adult population. And I know that I will say older adults just absolutely adore their pets, and just the importance of the human animal bond as it relates to this group is just so phenomenal to see. And I have some quotes that I'd love to share later, but I do think in terms of costs and kind of just the difficult things that have kind of risen within the last year or two since COVID, does seem to be really across the board.
Hey folks, we'll be right back to All Paws Pet Talk Radio and TV. So stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Burt Ward, Robin from Batman, and I believe there is nothing more precious than life. 20 years ago, we got a dog for our daughter to grow up with, and she became our daughter's best friend. Everything we did with our dogs, she did with her dog. Then she fell in love with two Great Dane puppies. We were worried because we knew that large dogs normally live only 7 to 9 years. But we found a way to keep her dogs and our dogs wonderfully healthy and living many years longer. Living as long as 27 healthy, active years. We created Gentle Giants, a special low-fat, heart-healthy, super premium dog food and a unique feeding and care program that we believe has added precious years to the lives of our dogs. And we'd like to do the same thing for you and your dog. Life doesn't have to be too short for your best friend. All natural, Gentle Giants, for the longer, healthier, happier life of your dog.
Gentle Giants for life.
Folks, welcome back to All Paws Pet Talk Radio. What I say is that this button down here with the mute's causing me a little bit of trouble.
I figured, Dad, when you didn't come right back, I thought like, uh-oh.
But the main thing I wanted to ask Morgan is, so, I mean, I go to various industry trade shows. Who is supplying the pet food for all the different, first of all, how many Meal on Wheels organizations are there across the nation?
So that's a great question. In total, there's about 5,000 community-based organizations that provide these services. We have 1,100 that are Meals on Wheels America members. And about 44% of those offer pet services. I know you didn't ask that, but I love to share that number just because it is really high. So
that is really high. And so how do you go about securing the supplies and the food that and how do you even predict this, especially with pet food inflation is running twice as high as human food inflation. So I'm sure that you're getting, your budget is getting hit pretty hard too, right?
It's a good question. You know, first of all, I'll just start by saying that we offer our Meals on Wheels Loves Pets grant program annually. And that we're really grateful to have support from PetSmart Charities for. They fund that grant program. We just actually released funded nearly $800,000 to 93 different Meals on Wheels programs. So we're really excited about that. Those funds will support access to pet food, access to vet care. And again, we're supported by PetSmart Charities. But a big part of what my work looks like on a day-to-day basis is working with Meals on Wheels providers to develop local community partnerships. So whether that's with animal welfare organizations, humane societies, even local grocery stores and pet food distributors, to really work with them to partner in ways where they can provide more food to more clients just on different levels in each community. So we really do have a lot of different ways and resources that we can help Meals on Wheels providers to really gain access to more pet food and more pet care services. But it's definitely tough times with things being expensive and, you know, food being so hard to get, just as you mentioned.
I belong to our local Rotary Club, and a few months ago we had a food, kind of at the end of the COVID thing, we did in one of the local parks a food giveaway. Most of the food, I understand, came from Amazon. A lot of it came, I think, from Walmart, if I'm not mistaken. But we partnered with an organization. It wasn't Meals on Wheels, but it was another local organization. And besides all, it was a drive-through situation where people drove through and we had different stations where people would load their cars up with food. One of the stations was pet food. We had several pallets of pet food lined up, and it was amazing. The pet food ran out long before the human food did. I was not prepared to see that many people that were actually looking for food for their animals as opposed to for themselves and their families.
Yeah, it's, I will say, I attended the Humane Society's annual expo this year, and there was this really awesome session on community food pantries, and that was something that was echoed across. There were a few other human services agencies there, and then also, of course, I think the ASPCA was there and several other animal welfare folks, and they said the same exact thing of, you know, we've set up these pet pantries, you know, for anyone in the community, and pet food is just going so quickly. That seems to be the case across the board, and wish it wasn't so, but it's also awesome that these entities are able to kind of engage so quickly and provide these resources that are, you know, so needed.
You know, Morgan, what's very, very interesting also is a lot of the communities have a lot of behavioral issues with their dogs because of where they live or whatever. And I've been doing a lot of pro bono work for a lot of groups, rescues and shelters. And what I've seen is how many people, especially the one nonprofit I work with up in upstate New York, the number of people relinquishing their pets, and a lot of them are really good. I take rescue dogs and train them over about a year and a half to 2 years and turn them into service dogs. We used to be focused on trying to find that good dog, the one out of 100 that had the ability to do that job. And we now have, I mean, 1 or 2 year old labs, goldens, beautiful, like some purebred dogs, some, you know, mix of this or that. But one thing is that a lot of people, when they've had to downsize from a home or an apartment or something that was pet friendly to not being in that same situation, a lot of these people have also turned into the service animal or, you know, emotional support animal fake registries that are out there, where I think that the biggest problem is more people. And again, you know, with Meals on Wheels, I'm sure you have people who are going to be like losing their homes. They're at that point. They can't pay rent. They can't pay mortgage or whatever. And a lot of them will just go through whatever they have to because they don't want to relinquish their animals, whether it's due to they can't afford the food or they can't afford a place or find a place that will accept them with animals. I'm just curious if you have any, you know, gravitas or any kind of ability to work with some of these larger locations, apartment complexes, et cetera, to show them how, you know, they could charge a little pet fee and allow people to keep their pets so those pets don't have to be relinquished to a shelter or a rescue. I know it's kind of an edgy question, but you guys are pretty big. Maybe there's something you can do. Maybe legal department can help out, because that's one of the things I see. Sometimes it's not even just the cost of the insurance or the cost of the pet or the cost of the food. But when they downsize, they can't find a place to keep the pet and themselves that's pet friendly.
It's a great question. And this is actually something that I hear about quite frequently, but it's actually almost, I will say in some ways, kind of the opposite of this, and I'll explain why. But first of all, each Meals on Wheels pet program that exists operates typically very differently. So some may provide access to vet care only, some may focus on pet food, really kind of the whole scope. Mm-hmm. And so many programs are very, very involved in this, and where they're hearing about issues with housing or, you know, getting a call of I'm moving into this place and I'm really worried about my pet not coming with me. I mean, they are on the front lines. They are responding to those complaints and not complaints, those concerns so quickly. So in many cases, it comes up very frequently of, hey, I just moved. I'm, you know, my pet doesn't have, you know, these 3 vaccines that they need to be able to stay in this facility. Can you help me? And in so many cases, I almost want to say literally 100%, these Meals on Wheels programs are coming, working with their vet partners, their vet providers, and getting these animals vaccinated or providing them with, you know, really whatever is needed in that moment to be able to keep them together, happy and healthy at home.
Okay. As a veterinarian, I the only, you know, concerns that I have, and you know, you've touched on a lot of problems that people are facing, is that when people can't afford to continue to purchase, you know, either the higher quality or premium foods or even just, you know, the regular foods, but the brand name foods, you know, the ones that are all part of the American Association of Pet Food Manufacturing, you know, they're all certified to meet minimum standards and things. And people have to start economizing. Obviously, they make some hard choices. And one of the problems that we see people going into the cheaper foods, you know, the feed store brands, you know, the Wonder Dog, the Super Dog, the Hunter's Field Master Choice or whatever, is the nutritional aspect. You know, yeah, you're filling up the animal's stomach and maybe you're feeling okay because you had something to put in the dog or the cat's or the horse's bowl that night, but you're opening them up to a whole host of malnutrition problems, everything from digestive disorders to food allergies to dental problems to stunted growth in the case of puppies, skin conditions, you know, any number of health problems due to inferior foods. And I know as a charity, Morgan, you're probably in no position to turn down free food that's offered to you. But long term feeding some of these things to the animals, you know, how much are we contributing perhaps to health problems that are going to ultimately cost way more than just the food? Just a quick aside, you know, when I was a poor veterinary student, I had a cat, which I probably needed like a hole in the head, but someone gave it to me and I couldn't afford to buy food. And I would just pass by the local butcher shop every day with a little plastic bag and the guy would load it up with guts and chicken scraps and whatever was free. And I would just dump it in front of the cat and the cat was happy to have it. And, you know, it ultimately grew up to be healthy, but not something I would recommend to my clients to do. So I don't know, how have you found that the quality, not so much the quantity, but the quality of what you have available to give to people plays?
So that's a good question. I, you know, as I noted a little bit earlier, I think each program really kind of deals with their partnerships, their donations, their distributions of pet food differently. So I can't quite answer for all programs, but I will say so many programs are so careful and thoughtful about what they are providing to clients. And clients are so thoughtful too of, you know, making sure that their pet stays on the same diet, pieces along those lines. But what happens and what I've seen in so many cases where Meals and Wheels providers have these awesome partnerships with veterinary clinics and veterinarians in their community is they're often going to these partnerships that they have and talking to their vet about, hey, here's the food that we're planning to provide to our clients, you know, do you have feedback, like really checking in and kind of getting as much guidance through that partnership as they can. And that's something that I think is just so resourceful that they've been able to kind of do over and over again, is to just utilize the partnerships and the expertise to really make sure that their clients and pets are cared for in the, you know, the food that they're getting.
You know, it's really interesting, Morgan, because that's one of the things that as a behaviorist I see, especially, I remember there was one particular lady, she had four female pit bulls. She was in the Dallas, Texas area. She had lost her job and she switched dog foods from a very good premium food to something else that had a lot of wheat and a lot of allergens in it. Three of the dogs did fine. The fourth dog became extremely aggressive. It took about 2 weeks. The dog got increasingly aggressive. She called me because I was going to Texas to do some work there. And she called me and I said, listen, do me a favor. The three that are doing fine, keep them on that. But the fourth one, I have a feeling, might have a food allergy and a sensitivity, probably to wheat, because I've seen a lot, especially with animals who either they don't feel well or it causes inflammation, the same as it can cause a hot spot and inflammation in the skin. It can also cause inflammation in the brain, which can lead to behavioral changes. We switched that dog back to the same food it had been on. The other three dogs were fine. And she said within a week, the dog went back pretty much to being the dog that it had been. So I saw that firsthand because she was a super nice lady. She rescued these pit bulls. She was just, you know, trying to do the right thing. She couldn't afford to feed all four of them, all of that. But she did change the one. Hi, Kitty. She did change the one back and it worked out really well for her. So I'm just like, along with what Dr. Don says as well, I think if your dog or your pet isn't super sensitive to things, you probably have fewer issues than if you do have an animal who has some, you know, skin sensitivities or allergies, because certainly going to the veterinarian and throwing a Cytopoint or Apoquil into a dog or a cat is going to be more expensive than trying to get a different kind of food. So I think that's a really valid what Don was saying, you know, with people when they lose their job or they have to downsize, or perhaps they get another animal foisted on them. You know, somebody just gives you another animal. We always try to do our best, but it's nice to know that there are organizations like yours, like the food, you know, the Meals on Wheels, who are providing food not just for humans and are doing it for the animals. Same thing as when people, we have a facility we're purchasing in Florida that's on the I-95 corridor, so that when the hurricanes are coming up the coast and people have to leave and try to get wherever they can to safety, they'll be able to leave their animals with us. And when they are coming back, they won't have to lose their animal. And it's kind of a cool project. But, you know, I love the fact that Meals on Wheels is really focusing on the animals. Because listen, I wouldn't leave here if I had a fire in my house 30 years ago and my husband was in there and our two dogs were in there. And I hate to say, and he was the greatest guy in the world. I got my two dogs out and got them out, put them in my car. It was in the middle of winter, got them safe. And then I ran back in to get my husband. So I think a lot of people might, maybe not that extreme, but our animals are our children and our animals are like everything to us. And the thought of having to give one up, it would like be giving your child up. And I'm so grateful that you and your organization are helping. I just wonder, how can people watching our show now find out how to get some of the help from you with all the different opportunities that you're providing to people?
It's a great question. The number one thing I would recommend, and I'm going to do a long URL and a short Google search, but what you can do, one, if you're interested in receiving services, or two, even interested in partnering or volunteering with a local Meals on Wheels provider in your community, is you can go to mealsonwheelsamerica.org/find-meals. If that's, you know, a pretty long URL and you didn't get a chance to write it down, you can also just go to Google and type in Meals on Wheels Find Meals. And that will pop up with a link that will allow you to put in your zip code and it will pull up the closest Meals on Wheels providers near you. Not all Meals on Wheels providers, again, offer those pet services. But again, with that 44% of services being provided, it is very likely that there are pet services nearby. And I see that just popped up in the side tab. So I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Just give us a few minutes. We're going to go to station identification and let our sponsors speak. In the meantime, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
I'm Burt Ward, Robin from TV's Batman, inviting you to feed your dog Gentle Giant's canned dog and puppy food, prepared with fresh meats, fresh fruits, and fresh vegetables that can make a huge difference in taste and nutrition for your dog. Our 27-and-a-half-year-old wolfhound, Tara, has lived more than triple her normal lifespan, eating only Gentle Giant's dry dog food mixed with Gentle Giant's canned dog food at Target, HEB, and stores near you. Try Gentle Giant's cat and kitten food, too.
Gentle Giant's for life.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to All Paws Pep Talk Radio and TV. We are here with Morgan from Meals on Wheels. And, you know, I was just during the break mentioning to Morgan that in some ways the fact that we are having this conversation is sad because so many people depend on help or there is so much food insecurity out there. And what it also means is that the animalist and human-animal bond really is so important for even the health of the humans that just making sure that the animals can stay in the home and provide, especially some of our elderly folks, that warmth and companionship is just really, really important. And with that, what I would like to know from you, Morgan, is since we are delving into this, tell me an inspirational story or two.
Absolutely. I have one quote. It's a little bit, it's not too long, but it's a little bit long. I just wanted to read it because I do think it really drives home just the true importance of kind of, as you mentioned, the human-animal bond, also these services. And then I've got a happy story about some dog treats. But the quote here says, I live alone. The only support I have to keep me active is my dog. He is the reason why I was able to survive the pandemic lockdown. I'm on a fixed income and it's hard for me to keep food on the table for myself, let alone my dog. I know some people think we should not have an animal or a pet and cannot if I can't afford to feed them. But without my dog, I most likely would not have survived the pandemic. I fell during the pandemic and ended up in acute care facility for 6 months. If I did not have my dog to come home to, I believe I would not have had the will to live. I have no children and have never been married. So my Vincent is the only reason to live as I am 80 years old. I'm now having a hard time being able to leave my home. So he is my world now. That was just a quote from a client that, again, I think kind of drives home the pieces that I mentioned earlier. But I also had a story. This is one of my favorites. We had a new pet program that had just started providing pet food deliveries to their neighborhood. And within that pet food deliveries, they had also thrown in some treats that I believe had been part of the service that they did for their first few deliveries. And they got a call. I think it was a few days after the pet food deliveries had gone out. And it was from a client who was just so excited, really emotional from what was kind of relayed to me in the story. And he just shared that it was so exciting to him and special because his pet had never had a dog treat before. And so this was something that was just so helpful to him, helpful to his pet, and was just very special. So I just wanted to share those two stories. I have probably 100 others to pull from just because I get them every single day, but it's very heartwarming to hear just really how effective this programming is.
Well, and what kind of increase in demand for your services have you seen, both on the human and pet side, let's say, since COVID?
It's a good question. Our research that we completed was done during COVID. The results were released in 2021. And then we did a second round of research, which we have not released a full report on that yet. The need is definitely increasing. I think a big part of my work is really talking and working with Meals on Wheels providers who don't have pet programs to see how we can support, encourage them to apply for grant funding just to really start or dip their toes into these services to start providing them. Because we do know, with that 20% number of that I mentioned earlier, that these services are definitely needed and just are continuing to rise.
And to Janet's point earlier, Janice's point earlier, what about geographic areas? Are you seeing some areas more affected than others?
That's a good question. What we've really focused on is looking at our national kind of layout where Meals on Wheels America members are and where there are gaps in service. And so we have been working, again, with the support of PetSmart Charities through several different grant programs to really expand into areas that maybe we don't have pet programming currently. I would say similar with a lot of our food services, the East and the West Coast are very much so populated in terms of programming. And then I think once you get into kind of the central United States where those more rural areas are, that's kind of where we're really working to expand and to keep growing.
Morgan, I have a question. A large carriage house, I could certainly store food or whatever was donated. Let's say I wanted, or somebody listening has a warehouse or has a place where we'd be willing to allow those donations to be. How would we get involved in that, in, you know, kind of supporting Meals on Wheels and perhaps adding a location like a pet pantry in our area or where we already have a place? Is that something that they look for, and how does that work? What does that look like if, let's say, somebody has a warehouse or somebody has a carriage house or a garage and they're willing to allow that to be kind of a location? How would that work with like local zoning or with local laws or ordinances? And is that something that Meals on Wheels would help in order to get a new location? You know, it's kind of a long kind of drawn out question.
No, it's a fantastic question. Storage is one of the number one questions that we get from new and existing pet programs, because you can get an amazing and wonderful donation of pet food, but if you don't have any place to store it, it's really hard to figure out what to do next. And so a lot of our Meals on Wheels members have gotten very creative in, you know, who they're partnering with. I've heard of Meals on Wheels members partnering with the sheriff's office, churches, pieces, just kind of that you wouldn't think of in terms of partnerships for storage. But if you ended up having storage, we're interested in providing support, I can tell you 9.9 times out of 10, a pet program would be so grateful and would be very willing to kind of work with you and kind of have discussions to get that started. So I would say if you're interested, just going to that mealsonwheelsamerica.org/find-meals to reach out to your local provider first. Additionally, if you had questions about it and we're having trouble maybe locating your closest program, you can also email me at pets@mealsonwheelsamerica.org. I'm happy to make connections as much as I can.
Thanks. So how about if you wanted to become a provider? So let's say, because I already do a lot of pro bono work with behavior. We have a program. We actually get dog items and actually people items, bicycles, things like that. And we send them off to Ghana. But this would be something, I think a lot of us, especially where in the area I live, I'm in New Jersey, There's a lot of need for it. How would you go about becoming like a new chapter of Meals on Wheels to be able to help not only humans, but also helping with the animals?
That is a fantastic question. I believe there's more information on the MealsOnWheelsAmerica.org website. Basically, if you start your own 501c3 organization, you are serving home delivered meals or older adults, you would be eligible for the Meals on Wheels America membership, in which case you could be partner or connected with local peers and other members, kind of going back to that 1100 number that I mentioned. But I believe there are more resources on the website. It's a really great question. And hopefully the resources can help. If you do have more questions and you are interested, again, happy to respond to individual questions too at that pets@mealsonwheelsamerica.org email address too.
Morgan, I've got a client who every year hosts an annual Christmas party for a lot of the movers and shakers and people in the community. And one of the things she does at this party, which is huge, they get, you know, maybe 100 people show up, is everybody has to bring a donation of a bag or something of pet food, cat food, dog food, whatever. And she collects a huge amount of it. And every year we donate it to, I mean, it fills up a truckload, and we donate it to one of the local animal rescue groups that desperately needs it. But it's a one-time effort. It's done at, you know, at Christmas time. And so, you know, the first of the year, we bring this big truckload, and it may last them for, you know, maybe 2 months, 6 weeks. And then there's nothing for the rest of the year. What would you suggest, you know, to local people or charities or individuals what would you suggest to try to make this into an ongoing or a continuous effort? You know, it's just like, you know, throwing a man a fish for one day and you fed him, but how do you sustain it?
And that's something that we're really focused on, specifically through storytelling, fundraising, marketing efforts. Pet food drives are highly encouraged and things that we encourage members to participate in, start their own. We have some kind of, like you mentioned, to participate. I know there's one member that I'm thinking of that has a partnership with a dog park, and they do a pet food drive for them. It's either once or twice a year, but the amount of food that they raise is actually enough to sustain them for nearly the full year. And then they have a plan for pet food for the remainder of the year that maybe that food doesn't cover. So sustainability in terms of doing outreach to the community, partnering again, kind of like I mentioned, with local grocery stores and other partners in the community who can help just utilize opportunities for sustainability for pet food in the community, if that makes sense.
Well, one of the things that we can do going forward is make sure that we stay in contact, because as a person who operates in the pet industry, we come in contact with all of the pet food companies. And I'm sure that's a key, is to make sure, whether it's via the distributors they sell to or directly. But I mean, everybody here on this show knows that when you go to the grocery store or even to PetSmart, the dry food aisle is kind of empty because they're just way behind on kibble production. And I can't for the life of me figure out why. But everybody's got the labor shortages, and so therefore there are shortages on the shelf. And I'm sure it becomes even harder, especially at this time, to provide a consistent product, to your point, Doc. But yeah, it's certainly all needed. And by the way, Morgan, have you ever heard of the Human-Animal Bond Research Institute?
Haber, yes. We love their work. They have a great weekly email and just are very impressed with all that they put out too.
I just think it's awesome the work they do as well, because they basically quantify and publish research all based on the human-animal bond and the benefits of it. And so to your point of the letter that you read about the lady who survived COVID just because of her pet, I mean, God bless that woman and her pet. That's what we're looking for. So, Morgan, I can't thank you enough for coming on, for the work you guys are doing. I know there's going to be more and more of it needed. Again, I want to connect with you offline and see how we can help. Folks, anything else for Morgan? Otherwise, she's got places to call and people to get involved.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're grateful to you for coming on the show and for educating people. If people need the help, do they just go to the website that you were mentioning? Maybe we can shoot that on there one more time, because I know there are a lot of people who would need your help.
Yep, absolutely. MealsOnWheelsAmerica.org/find-meals, or again, you can just type in Meals on Wheels, Find Meals in your Google or Bing or whatever search engine you're using, and it will be the first link to pop up.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Morgan.
Thanks so much for having me.
I can't thank you enough, Morgan, and thank you, cohorts, partners in crime, partners in pets, partners in paws. All Paws Pet Talk Radio and TV will be back.
I'm Burt Ward, Robin from TV's Batman, and I believe there's nothing more precious than life.
From the first bites as a puppy to the senior years, Gentle Giants is the only food your dog needs for life. Gentle Giants for life.
Folks, welcome back to All Paws Pet Talk Radio and TV. We're talking with Dr. Marty Becker, fear-free Marty Becker. And so, Marty, one of the things I wanted to talk about briefly with you is, you know, you and Don talked about when you guys came into the profession that you had to have somewhat of an agricultural animal background. It wasn't just something you chose when you got out of high school and had entry. And so we want to cover this topic in more detail in the future, but it seems that there's a veterinary shortage out there. And I wanted to get your take on why you think that is and what might be the causes behind it and what we can do about it.
Yeah. Well, Chris, it's just a fact. When Dr. Don and I'm 69, we look like we're about the same age. We're probably both getting ads for walk-in tubs and constipation and erectile dysfunction products. We guess we're about the same age. Most of the kids, there were 73 kids in my class, and I'm just going to guess 65 were from farms and ranches. I suppose part of it was that was where the interest was, because you tend to be what you can see. And when you were on a farm or ranch, you saw the veterinarian come out and the cow with milk fever gave it some calcium and it rose up and ran off. And the horse, they gave it something and it fell down to castrate it. And you're thinking, wow, these pretty powerful people. And I love animals and these people have a lot of respect and they went to school. But all of us had seen live births, multiple live births, whether it was calves or colts or piglets or chickens hatching or puppies or kittens in a haystack. And we were used to handling everything. You just grew up with it from the time. And so now, and it was primarily a male profession. I think there were 8 girls out of the 73 in our class. And now it's changed. It's mostly a female profession. I think they're really good. They bring a lot of stuff that's better, but very few of them have extensive animal handling. And Janice had mentioned earlier about you've either kind of learned it intuitively, experienced it, been trained on it, or you how to handle these animals. You know, Janice and Dr. Don can walk into a county fair or somebody's neighborhood and know exactly if this horse is stressed or if this dog is being territorial. So now we come back to the question. So why is there a shortage? Why do people all of a sudden have 2 to 4 weeks to get in to see a veterinarian, which is unthought of? And we were always, my sister's a physician and might take 2 months to get into her as a nephrologist. But if you have a cat with a kidney problem, you're going to get in the same day. And still there's ER clinics and you push forward emergencies, but there's just too few people trying to do too much to too many animals. Now, let me give you a statistic. The North American Veterinary Technicians Association has 50-some thousand members. So if you have an RVT, an LVT, a CVT, they're all the same thing. There's somebody that's gone through a college program and got a specific training. It depends on the state what they're called. They did a study around 2020, and it's usually a 2-year education, and you spend $40,000. And after 5 years, 6 out of 10 of those people had left the profession. So they spent $40,000. A lot of them missed 2 years of earning capacity. Not all of them. Some trained where they worked. Why would you lose 6 out of 10? It's not the salary, it's not the hours, but it's the perceived brutality of practice. And a lot of those people, I love animals, I want them to love me back. And they get into veterinary medicine and they love the animals hate them back because they're in fear-based aggression. And so that's a big part of it is one is setting an expectation, but also learning how to handle animals in a way to where these animals don't feel like they're going to be harmed or killed. And people don't feel like they're hurting their pet by trying to help it. That's the worst thing. If you feel like, oh God, I should take it to the vet, but it thinks it's going to die, so I just won't take it in there. And meanwhile, the teeth look like a flamethrower went across it, or the ear looks like a fire pit. Imagine how that would feel. So what's the solution for not enough veterinarians? There's 4,500 veterinary students per year, approximately. Let's take my alma mater, Washington State University College of Veterinary Medicine. The lecture hall fits 125 people. Do you realize if we were going to increase the students by 50 students, where are we going to put them? And also, all veterinary schools have a shortage of staff members. So they can't compete with specialty hospitals. So there's not enough people to teach them. And it's going to be, and I think, Don, you alluded to this earlier, people don't even want to be a veterinarian. When I went to school, it was 16 applicants for every opening for veterinary school in 1976. And people would say, it's harder to get in veterinary school than medical school. That was correct at the time. Well, guess what? That's no longer correct. Guess what it is right now? 1.4 applicant for every opening to veterinary school. Now, Florida State or Washington State may say, oh, we still have 6,000 applicants. That's because they can apply to all veterinary schools with one application. And before, you applied to Washington State as an individual person, and you applied to Colorado State as an individual person. So if you go through the number of openings and the number of unique applicants, 1.4 to 1. So they're just not, it's not a financially lucrative profession. Too much student debt, not high enough salaries, extremely stressful. Yeah, I'm talking the bad things. There's all the good things, right? Don and I still love it, still practice, but it's tough when they can go out and get a four-year degree in computer science and make way more money with no debt. Got to remember, a veterinarian, the average is 8 years of lost earning capacity with a starting salary of $90,000 with an average of, I don't know what it is, Don, $175,000, $200,000 in debt. It just doesn't pencil out. So to get what the solution is probably going to be, one would be to bring in more foreign veterinarians. They're underemployed in many parts of the world, whether this is Mexico or China, and get them practice ready with English. Another one would be to, this is done in Washington State, where they have split up now to where the Washington legislature has authorized people to do tasks beyond what a typical team member could do. So in the past, you only have to have a veterinary technician is the only one that can do certain things. And they're splitting it up where there's a surgery technician, there's a pharmacy technician, there's a transcriptionist. And so they're splitting the workload up. So now a veterinarian and a technician working with these people that are legally authorized to do these other tasks, that is possible. So I would just end, again, I think I'm brevity challenged, Chris, I'm sorry, but I would never discourage somebody. It is the most interesting profession. You're never going to be bored being a veterinarian, I'll tell you. There's tough cases to crack. It is extreme. If you love animals like I think all of us on this show do, and that's one of the things I'm proud of, Fear Free. You can love animals and have them love you back. And if you don't mind, I might get in a tiny commercial. If anybody out there has a shelter or rescue, or you're working with the shelter or rescue in your practice, fearfreeshelters.com is complimentary to all shelter employees and volunteers. There's 90,000 people have completed a 5-hour online course. I wouldn't do a 5-minute online course, so I got to respect these people that would go through 5 hours. And also, Fear Free Happy Homes is complimentary to all pet parents. And Don, one thing that's interesting, 4/5 of all veterinary schools in the United States now require fear-free certification of all students before graduation. And the Association of Veterinary Tech Educators wants to make fear-free mandatory for the 257 AVMA accredited programs by the end of next year. So they're not going to learn, you know, Janice and Don, we had to cast a horse off his feet, which basically means you trip them off their feet. You know, we had to put a cow in to dehorn it with nose tongs in and stuff like that. Well, we got drugs now. And it's not going to be as, Don, when you took theriogenology, which is reproduction, we'd go out there to this one cow, the truck would unload, and the cow would be bucking in the chute, and the professor, you son of a, god dang it, and twist its tail. And now I look back and I think, okay, all of us students are going to put our arm up this cow's ass with a sleeve on, and we don't know what we're doing. You're trying to feel through their rectal wall and actually grab their ovary. Not easy. And the sleeves all have an edge on them. And I don't care how much lubricant you put on there, after the second or third one, going in and out and in and out and feeling around in there, when you pull your arm out, there'd be blood. So I'm thinking now, this cow, who would want somebody to stick their arm up there with a sleeve that's running it raw to blood? You come back and you look at it differently now. That poor cow. Yeah, there's simulation and there's cadavers and all this other stuff, but we've got to rethink our animal handling, really, of all species. And I'll leave it at that.
All Paws Pet Talk Radio and TV will be back. See you next time.